Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
And good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta, glad to be with you. You got 2 hours ahead of us. Let's talk about some of the things that matter most. Like yesterday and today, we've been taking a look at the top stories of 2021. We usually do this a little earlier in the month, but as you know, I was gone because of the passing of my mother, so I was out in Connecticut for a little over a week. And what I want to do today was go over the top pro-life stories of last year. We're going to talk that over with Dr. Monica Miller, who will be joining me. We're going to look at the top bioethics stories of 2021. Wes Smith will be joining us. You remember, Wes has been a frequent guest with us on bioethical topics. And we're also going to be joined by Rob Muse from the American Freedom Law Center on the top religious liberty stories of last year, as well as the recent Supreme Court decision on mandates. In the second hour of the program, we're going to go to talk with Sam Gregg of the Acton Institute. What to do about China? It's the conventional wisdom when I was in college and afterwards, shortly after, for about at least 15 years after I got out of college, the conventional wisdom regarding China was that Nixon had opened the door to China. And then when Mao died in 1976, China was a little more open to watching the United States, and Mao's successor, Deng Xiaoping, decided to kind of reform China's economy to make it more amenable to market concerns. And the common wisdom was that eventually China, when it had greater economic freedom, the people would begin to demand greater political freedoms. And so the question we need to ask, and actually President Trump asked this question, has China's gradual entry into global markets produced a more open and free China when you take a look at its handling of political, religious, and civil liberties? And the answer is it doesn't look like it's become a more liberal country. We're going to talk it over with Sam Gregg, and there's more coming up. But first, today's headlines.
Thank you, Al, and good afternoon, everyone. This is Ave Maria Radio News for Wednesday, January 19th. It's the Feast of St. Fillian. And today's news is brought to you by Charity Mobile, supporting pro-life and Catholic causes at charitymobile.com. Supreme Court Justices Sonia Sotomayor and Neil Gorsuch are disputing a report that Sotomayor had been working from home due to Gorsuch's refusal to wear a COVID mask. NPR correspondent Nina Totenberg published the report yesterday. In a joint statement today, the justices said the report is false, adding, while we may sometimes disagree about the law, we are warm colleagues and friends. French President Emmanuel Macron is calling for abortion to be added to the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights. Speaking to the European Parliament today, he said the Rights Charter, which was ratified in the year 2000, needs to be more explicit on environmental protection and the recognition of the right to abortion. The current EU Charter does not mention abortion, but in June, the Parliament voted in favor of a report describing abortion as an essential health care. The Secretary of State says diplomacy will be pursued with Russia as long as possible. Anthony Blinken's remarks come as he's set to meet with the Russian Foreign Minister on Friday. A Russian foreign policy analyst told Reuters the meeting is probably the last stop before the train wreck. Starbucks has rescinded its requirement that employees be vaccinated against COVID-19. The Seattle-based company made the decision following the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling that imposed a stay on the Biden administration's plan to require vaccinations or testing for companies with more than 100 employees. The company is strongly encouraging employees to be vaccinated. And a bill that would prevent most abortions in Florida after 15 weeks is up for debate today. A Florida House subcommittee is considering the so-called reducing fetal infant mortality measure. The bill is similar to a Mississippi law taken up by the U.S. Supreme Court last month. current Florida law bans abortion after 24 weeks. With your Ave Maria Radio News, I'm Dan McGraw.
And good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. You heard Dan just mention this really, what amounted to a bunch of gossip. And to make it worse, false gossip. I'm talking here about the claim from Nina Totenberg over at NPR that somehow Justice Sotomayor wanted Judge Gorsuch to wear a mask and managed to get Chief Justice Roberts to kind of pressure him to wear a mask. Well, the whole story is invented. There's no evidence for it. It was picked up by media operations, you know, all over the United States. And while it's not a, in terms of its substance, it's not a great big story, but it is very enlightening about how veterans like Nina Totenberg, who's been over there at NPR, I bet you it's pushing 50 years now. I think we have her, when we checked earlier today, we had her reporting on some Supreme Court stories as early as 1977. So you're looking at a long time, 45, 50 years. Here's my point. This story that she laid out, and it was a long story too, because it went into the divisive attitudes among members of the Supreme Court. But it was based on an invention. So, for instance, this was so outrageously bad that Neil Gorsuch and Sonia Sotomayor issued a joint statement earlier today saying that this recent NPR report was, quote, false. You know, NPR claimed that the conservative justice, Neil Gorsuch, refused to wear a mask on the bench despite requests to do so by the Chief Justice and by liberal justice, Sonia Sotomayor. So playing up again, the opposition. You got to have good guys and bad guys. And, of course, for Nina Totenberg, the good guys are those who are, you know, political liberals. So she decided to have this story in which she claimed to examine conflicts between members of the Supreme Court. Quote, Gorsuch didn't mask despite Sotomayor's COVID worries, leading her to telework. That is, she wouldn't meet with the Supreme Court justices. She'd have to work from home using the telephone. Chief Justice John Roberts ordered the justices to wear masks because of the Omicron surge and because Sotomayor has diabetes. So, so Totenberg is painting Neil Gorsuch here as a guy of such little sophistication and such little human feeling that he wouldn't bother masking in spite of Sotomayor's vulnerability, right? He was going to – can you imagine? Gorsuch – Totenberg goes on to say, they all put masks on except Gorsuch, who, as it happens, sits next to Sotomayor on the bench. His continual refusal since then has also meant that Sotomayor has not attended the justices' weekly conference in person, joining instead by telephone. Gorsuch, from the beginning of his tenure, has proved a prickly justice, not exactly beloved even by his conservative soulmates on the court. So this was reported. NPR reports this on Tuesday. That's Tuesday morning, in fact. And then it was picked up again in the evening. To his credit, Brett Baer over at Fox got Shannon Bream, their chief legal analyst, to go track this story down. And Bream said, I am told that it is not accurate. She said, quote, a source at the Supreme Court says there have been no blanket admonitions or requests from Chief Justice Roberts that the other justices begin wearing masks to arguments. My source further stated that Justice Sotomayor did not make any such request to Justice Gorsuch. I'm told, given that fact, that there was also no refusal by Justice Gorsuch. And yet, this story went out from NPR on Tuesday morning, picked up by USA Today. Here's the headline. Report. Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch refuses to wear masks in the courtroom, despite requests from Roberts. CNBC titles their story, Supreme Court Gorsuch refused to wear mask despite request over Sotomayor's court COVID concerns. I'm looking at these things. I'm just shaking my head, wondering, you know, when the adults are going to take over again. Well, Rolling Stone took things further. It is interesting that now Rolling Stone is listed along here with USA Today and other more classical journalistic outlets. Rolling Stone says Neil Gorsuch stands up for his right to endanger Sonia Sotomayor's health. Yeah. And then it went on to say the liberal Supreme Court justice is diabetic and didn't want to sit next to justices who weren't wearing masks. Her conservative colleagues didn't care. Ooh, wow, those are bad, bad guys. CNN put it this way. Gorsuch declines to wear mask as benchmate Sotomayor works from her office. Newsweek, quote, Justice Neil Gorsuch slammed for not wearing mask, endangering diabetic Sonia Sotomayor. I mean, these are some of the chief news outlets in our country. Clearly, they never went ahead to confirm Nita Totenberg's story. And yet today, both Sotomayor and Gorsuch actually released a statement. And that's rare. It is rare for justices of the Supreme Court to respond to news stories like this. But this is how debased American journalism has become. And I think we should keep this in mind because these are big, well-funded operations that do a lot to shape our opinion here in the United States. And yet they are behaving like incompetence. They are basically working with a large macro narrative about hostility between conservative justices, who they define as conservative justices, and liberal justices. Even those categories are kind of messy, but it's the way the story gets told, so I'm going to use those categories. The justices themselves are certainly well aware of the differences between them. And yet, knowing how America right now is so shamelessly divided, not just divided about ideas, that's fine. There are going to be differences in ideas, but divided regarding personalities. So that Gorsuch, you can't just disagree with Gorsuch because of his judicial philosophy. You have to turn Gorsuch into a man with such a hard heart that he will not even honor his colleague Sotomayor's concerns over mask wearing and her jeopardizing her health because she's diabetic. You know, even if a decent person, even thinking that mask wearing is ineffective and doesn't do it, would show basic courtesy to Sotomayor. You know, and you can certainly rest assured that people, generally speaking, people of the stature of Supreme Court justices would have mastered at that time in their life that kind of basic courtesy. But see, it's not enough, again, it's hard to debate judicial philosophy, right? We don't know. I mean, words like originalism and textualism, original intent, there's lots of now you've got debates over what's called the Chevron doctrine. Look, most of us are not sitting around with a glossary trying to understand all these things. And big commercial media organizations know that. So they don't take the time to go into the actual differences of judicial philosophy. They give you the cartoon. They give you the bad guys and the good guys. And, of course, the bad guys happen to be the guys that those who are writing the stories disagree with. And the good guys, of course, are those who are writing the stories think, yeah, well, I agree with them. I like them. So you're treated to this ongoing cartoon approach to judicial philosophy. And it's just, it's wicked. I mean, I got an email the other day from somebody who I actually have tremendous respect for because of work I've known he's done in certain areas. But he sent this this Rasmussen poll that 59% of Democrats believe that people who are not vaccinated should not be able to leave their homes other than for emergencies. That means a clear majority of them believe that people who choose not to get the COVID shot should live under house arrest. And then it gets worse. 29% of Democrats believe the government should be able to take children away from parents who won't have them vaccinated. Stop for a minute. Just stop and think. What people say in answer to polls bears very little relationship to what they will actually do in reality. I remember this when we went up against physician-assisted suicide here in Michigan. The odds against us were enormous. I think the odds were 70 to 30, people favoring physician-assisted suicide. This goes back to around 2000. And it was we had a few months to overcome that prejudice. But once people began to hear the dangers of physician-assisted suicide, once they began to be aware of what was available through palliative care, they turned the whole thing around. And we won. We defeated physician-assisted suicide. Believe me, you put 100 Democrats in the room and you say to them, do you think, are you willing to stand with me and take children away from their parents if their parents won't vaccinate them? You're not going to get 30 Democrats out of 100 to join you. Think of the people you know and ask, would they do that?
Welcome to Spirit of Stewardship. Jeremy Belsky is your host for real-life stories, encouragement, and ideas to enhance your own gifts of work, wealth, and wisdom in response to God's blessings for you.
I'm Jeremy Belsky, and today's topic is Stewardship of the Environment, God's Creation of Nature. When you hear the message, be a wise steward of your resources, do you ever consider the role you play in your community environment? It's natural to think of time, talent, and treasure when stewardship is mentioned, but our faith teaches us that all is gift from God. Thus, respect for nature and doing our part to ensure a safe and clean environment is important. Here are just three areas we can pay more attention. A lot of action has been taken in recent years by nonprofits geared towards a cleaner environment. The first area of focus is to eliminate litter. Consider how your actions to pick up after yourself are pleasing to God. Be proud to do your part to keep your community and neighborhood clean. Secondly, look at ways to recycle and make the most out of your purchases. Does it matter to you that so much plastic consumes our landfills? Have you given thought as to how you can make a particular purchase last longer? Third, in a country filled with abundance, what's being done to ensure our nature and environment for the next generation? This is more than eating bread crust and cleaning off your plate. The root lies in not wasting what we've been given. There's a great deal of time and effort that goes into caring for our place of residence in addition to our possessions. Keeping up what is ours or giving our used possessions to the less fortunate are a couple of ways to be prudent stewards of our blessings from God. I'm Jeremy Belsky, your host for Spirit of Stewardship.
To learn how you can better share your talents and resources, contact your local parish priest. Your level of involvement in the church now positively impacts our faith in the future.
With so much going on in the world, it's easy to feel overwhelmed. What do you need to know today? Stay tuned to Cresta in the Afternoon and Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo as we bring you the day's top stories and conversations from an authentic Catholic perspective.
This week at Ave Maria Radio's Poll of the Week, we want to know, which of the major cases currently being considered at the Supreme Court do you think is the most significant? Go to AveMariaRadio.net and scroll down to the Poll of the Week to let us know.
Location, location, location. These are the three most important factors in real estate. The same might be said for colleges. Trudging through snow to get to an 8 a.m. statistics class is a much different experience than breezing by a palm tree to the raucous applause of a laughing gull. With the average temperature of 84 degrees and wetland nature as your backdrop, it's no wonder students tend to stay once they visit our campus. Ave Maria University, your future location, location, location. Visit avemaria.edu.
CMF Curo is a Catholic healthcare ministry providing families nationwide with a better solution centered around whole health, spirit, mind, and body. Our members share their medical burdens within a faith-filled community. At CMF Curo, our members have access to a spiritual director, concierge services, and other health and spiritual resources. Find out if CMF Curo is a better solution for your family. Visit mycatholichealthcare.com. That's mycatholichealthcare.com.
Underwritten in part by this not-for-profit.
Are you looking for peace? Longing for joy? Want to meet the giver of all goodness? God is calling the laity to bring Ignatian prayer into a suffering world. Work for the new evangelization. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com. Order your free digital training and manual. Find true happiness and everlasting joy. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com.
And click on the red button today.
It's free. Approved by the USCCB.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. We've been looking over the top stories of 2021 over the last 2 days. Today, we take a look at the top pro-life stories. And with me, Dr. Monica Miller, Director of Citizens for Pro-Life Society, the author of many books, including Abandoned, The Untold Story of the Abortion Wars. And you can follow her work at prolifesociety.com and over and at overturnrow.org. Well, it's good to see you.
Yes, great to be with you, as always.
Let's talk about, before we go to last year's stories, just talk to me about this letter that you sent to Bishop O'Connell, who is the ordinary of the Diocese of Trenton,
right,
New Jersey.
Well, some of your listeners may already be aware that last week, Governor Philip Murphy of New Jersey, who professes to be a Catholic, basically codified, signed into legislation a bill that expands the killing of the unborn all the way to birth. Now, this, you know, actually, I think that this is pertinent to what I would consider a top story of 2021, and that is the way in which the bishops wrestled, if you want to use that word.
Sidestepped.
Well, so far, I guess that would be fair as well. But they took up the issue of, you know, as the jargon goes, Eucharistic incoherence.
Yeah.
And the problem of the pro-abortion Catholic politician and Joseph Biden being at the head of that group, continuing to present themselves for Holy Communion. And they did issue last November, as a result of their assembly, the bishops, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops Fall Assembly, a document on the Eucharist. I actually wrote a commentary on that document, which was in a sense kind of the climax, if you will, the end result of all of this struggle since the election of Biden.
Yeah.
So they come out with the document on the Eucharist. And I would say, as a document, it is a good primer on the centrality of Eucharistic worship in the church. And I I wrote my article. It was published November 30th, so very soon after the document was issued. And I very carefully, it was published in Crisis Magazine, I very carefully analyzed the document in terms of the principles embedded in that document that indeed give the bishops room to stand in disciplining these pro-abortion Catholic politicians.
Yeah.
It's in there.
It's there. I agree.
So now it has to, now there has to be, we have the words, now we need the action.
Again,
to feed this scandal with Philip Murphy in New Jersey signing this bill, I wrote a letter to the bishop of the Diocese of Trenton.
Yeah.
Trenton being, of course, the capital of New Jersey. And very possibly Governor Murphy attends a church there,
mm-hmm.
Maybe actually a parishioner at a particular parish. But I feel that I can't just let this issue die in my own soul.
You also point out the steps.
Yes.
That people have to realize there's a process here that bishops can take.
Right, and maybe I could quickly just jump
please.
Through them. They're very, very quick and very short. But the first thing is you have to meet with these politicians. I mean face to face.
That's right.
Sit down and meet with them.
Yeah.
And then what? Why? What are you going to do during the meeting? You're going to explain to, in this case, Governor Murphy, how his advocacy of abortion is a contradiction of the faith he claims to profess.
That's right.
And then you got to also furthermore explain that the right to life is not a mere confessional quirk of Catholicism.
Right.
All right, this is a right to, that exists according to the nature of the human person, irrespective of religion.
Yeah. Not just the Catholic thing.
And so you can't hide behind, this is just my private faith,
right.
Which is, of course, what they do all the time. And then the third point is, if this politician persists in his or her advocacy of abortion, then they have to be requested not to present themselves for Holy Communion.
Right.
And then maybe in some ways, the last point is the most important. You have to make it publicly known that you made the request.
Yeah.
That mitigates the scandal in terms of what is the responsibility of the church in relationship to Eucharistic coherency.
Right.
Now, having said all of that, Al, they could invoke Canon 915, the much neglected Canon 915, which calls for those who are in manifest grave sin and persist publicly sinning, as is the case with those who are promoting and facilitating the killing of the innocent, that they must not present themselves for Holy Communion. That is Canon 915.
Right.
And so I urge, this is just a letter of encouragement.
Yeah. Well, let's hope this this gets some traction. I don't think this is a futile effort. I know it feels futile, but I honestly think that we're going to see changes. I think we're in a big transition here.
Well,
I
wrote a very similar letter to Bishop William Koenig, who is the Bishop of Wilmington, Delaware.
Yeah.
I also find it a little ironic, and I think I in fact mention it in these letters, that back in 1988, we actually found the remains of aborted babies both in an abortion clinic in Fairfield, New Jersey, and in Wilmington, the Delaware, what was the name of that clinic? The Delaware Women's Health Organization Clinic. So I find it a little ironic, right in their own backyard, these victims of abortion passed through my hands.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Let's turn to last year.
Yep.
This Eucharistic coherence story regarding presentation for Holy Communion has an important abortion component to it, as you just pointed out. What are some of the other big abortion stories from last year?
Well, certainly Dobbs versus Jackson is almost at the top of the list, if not the top of the list. And everybody is waiting with bated breath to see what the United States Supreme Court will do, could do regarding legalized abortion and the 1973 Roe versus Wade decision. The court, I think, in the least, what's expected in the least, is that they will uphold the Mississippi law. So if a state, an individual state, wanted to restrict or ban abortion after 15 weeks gestational age, they would be permitted to do so.
There'd be no constitutional impediment.
Okay, so that's at the least the movement, the pro-life movement, is hoping for, and the other side is terrified.
Yeah.
Okay, and so we're glad about that. They should be afraid. But you know, my prayers, frankly, are that the court will go way beyond that, and in fact will just affirm that according to the language of the Constitution, the unborn are persons, and thus they are protected as persons under the protection of the 14th Amendment.
Right.
And
right.
Now we are done in terms of at least the legalized slaughter. Now,
that would be tremendous.
That would be amazing. Yeah. That would be an absolute miracle.
Yeah, it would be.
And I pray for that. I believe in miracles. And I think there may be some judges, Barrett, Alito, Thomas, that I think would, if they had the will to do it, they would do it.
Yeah.
And they see that there's a path to that end.
Yeah.
So I
and
I
it's also
encourage...
one of the weakest areas of Roe v. Wade was the historical analysis.
Yes.
About personhood.
Exactly.
And so this is it's a vulnerable.
So they have an opportunity to really do something enormous,
right.
An absolute sea change in terms of the moral foundation of our country and what it means to be human and what it means to be protected. And so I want to encourage listeners right now. This is what you got to be praying for.
Yeah. I think this is the biggest thing we've seen since Planned Parenthood v. Casey. So
I'm hopeful, but I'm always guarded. I hate to say it, but I'll believe it when I see it.
Yeah.
But that is my prayer.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is my prayer.
Yeah. I remember after the Webster decision, 1988, I think it was 88-89. I thought for sure that was the.
Yeah, and then
precursor.
There was Casey, and we were disappointed again.
And I thought
again,
by Casey, it was going to be over with, and then I was devastated after Casey. So,
but I think we have judges who I think see that Roe v. Wade was wrongly decided, and here's the ultimate tragedy of the whole thing. If Roe v. Wade gets reversed, and if the unborn are recognized as persons, 63 million innocent human beings will have been put to death, and we have to face that as a nation. We have to face the blood is there, and we're responsible for it.
Yeah.
And that's a huge admission that we slaughtered 63 million innocent human beings and on a mistake.
Yeah, you remember Bernard Nathanson?
Oh yes.
Yeah. He was troubled throughout the remainder of his life over his participation in the abortion industry. He was headed up one of the maybe the largest abortion abortuary in America at one time in New York City.
Yeah.
And I talked to him a few times over the years because he wrote some books and he eventually became Catholic.
Yes.
But to the end, my last conversation with him, he was still. Trying to figure out penitentially what could he do.
Yeah, his confession, even before, years before he became a Catholic, his public confession, that he presided over 70,000 deaths of unborn children.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, you raise a great point, and that is how do we handle that?
Right.
As a nation,
how do we repent of that as a nation? If we admit, do we have the humility? Do these judges and politicians and whomever is in charge of this decision, do they have the humility to admit that there was an error and thrust the nation into a period, a time of recognition that we killed 63 million persons?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that there, but I'm hit that we got to do it.
Yeah.
We have to face it.
Once you believe that, it's hard to live comfortably in the United States once you've decided that abortion kills a person.
Yes. You can't live a normal life anymore.
No,
it's what I said in my book.
Yeah, I know.
You can't live a normal life anymore.
Right. Well, Monica, thanks.
Thank you, Al. God bless
you. We'll talk soon. Bye-bye. Dr. Monica Miller, bringing us up to speed on some of the stories from last year. Two big stories, pro-life stories last year. I'm Al Kreston.
Solidarity HealthShare began out of the Christian tradition of neighbor helping neighbor. They're a nonprofit medical cost-sharing ministry in which their members share in each other's eligible medical expenses. Solidarity HealthShare is not insurance, but rather an alternative way to pay for medical costs that adheres to the teachings of the Catholic Church. They'll never share in a medical care that goes against their values and morals, such as abortion, contraception, and sterilization. More information available at SolidarityHealthShare.org or at 844-313-4999.
Who was the first Catholic in your family tree? Why did they choose to join the church? Was it the recommendation of a friend, a coworker, maybe a neighbor? Did you ever think that you could be that person who forever changes the lives of someone and their children, grandchildren, and generations to come? St. Paul's Street Evangelization invites you to consider this fact and join the thousands of evangelists who go out to invite people into a relationship with Jesus and His church. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more about how you can become a life changer.
And now, the EWTN Family Prayer with Father Joseph.
Family, a prayer that we pray together is a powerful prayer. So please pray together with me, our EWTN Family Prayer. Today we pray for the caregivers of the sick. O Most Holy Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, we adore you. You have first loved us, and through your Son you have taught us the excellence of self-giving love. Give to those who are caregivers of a sick parent or child, brother or sister, the assistance of your holy angels. Lessen their burdens and give them great joy in practicing a work of mercy. And since charity is never forgotten by you, reveal to them their heavenly reward. Amen.
Bishop Robert Barron.
Find out in any cultural situation, who's the Lord? There's somebody or some principle, some figure, some institution that has central importance in that culture. Whether it's king, whether it's the military, who knows what it is, go up and down the centuries. What's the Lord? The declaration of the Lordship of Jesus will always be a challenge to whatever that reigning Lord happens to be. The Lord today is my personal freedom. I decide what my life is. I decide who I am. I decide everything from my gender to the ultimate meaning of my life. Now that personal freedom is so powerful that it's become the Lord. To evangelize the culture is therefore to challenge them and to say, no, no, it's not your own ego, not your own freedom that's Lord. Jesus determines the meaning of your life. Jesus is the center of your life, not your own freedom.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
If I disciplined consistently, I'd be disciplining constantly. If I were consistent in my discipline, that would mean I would discipline more, and I'd be disciplining him often. The exact opposite is the case. More consistent discipline leads to less constant discipline. Why? Because you're predictable. The child knows if he does A, you'll do B. That is why, when you are predictable in your authority, you will actually have to use that authority less. Consistent discipline leads to less constant discipline. The more you act when you need to act, the less you will have to act in the future with similar misbehavior.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. We continue our look at the top stories of 2021. We'll take a look now in the field of bioethics. What were the big stories? And with us to chart those stories is Wes Smith. Wes is chair and senior fellow at the Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism. He's a consultant to the Patients' Rights Council and the author of 13 books. You can follow him on Twitter at TheWesleyJSmith. and check out his articles at National Review, First Things, and other places. And, of course, we have his work linked at our site as well. Wes, thanks for joining me today.
Well, thank you. And by the way, my greatest sympathies for the loss of your mother.
Oh, well, thank you. She gave me life. She gave me new life when she had me baptized. And then she actually showed me that a good death was achievable. And for me, that was a real gift from her. So,
you know, my father did that for me as well. And
really?
I think that's an important thing is that sometimes the last and best thing we can do for our children is to teach them how to die with true dignity,
right,
which means surrounded by people with love and accepting what comes with it.
Yeah, indeed. Speaking of those who have passed from this world, you wrote an obit for Mike Marker, past president of the Patients Rights Council, longtime husband of Rita Marker. I didn't know Mike, but I knew Rita and interviewed her quite often, and I've run into her son quite a bit when I've been traveling. But tell me about Mike Marker.
Yeah, Mike was a very special guy. He was more, in more recent years, a behind-the-scenes guy, but he was the president of the Patients' Rights Council, which, of course, has for many years advocated against euthanasia and assisted suicide, against things such as taking away the feeding tube of Terry Schiavo and this kind of thing, educating people, educating nursing homes, personnel, educating doctors, traveling on campuses. And Rita Marker, who many of your listeners will know, of course, was the face of the Patients' Rights Council. But mm-hmm. You might say that Mike was the heart.
Yeah.
He was behind the scenes. Interestingly, he used to be the face of the Patients' Rights Council, and Rita, because Rita had stage fright, and he helped her overcome the stage fright so that she could become the person who became the face. And then he took care of all the business aspects. He was also a very good at, the work of glad handing, making people feel comfortable, fundraising and this kind of thing. So a lot of people, will see nonprofit advocacy personnel, even me, for example, with the Discovery Institute and so forth. I'm a consultant to Patients' Rights Council. But there are a lot of people who you never see who
right.
are also integral to the work. And Mike was heart and soul of the Patients' Rights Council.
Well, I wish I'd had a chance to meet him. And it's hard for me to think of Rita having stage fright.
Yeah, I know, but she still does actually, but she thinks the work is so important she overcomes it.
Yeah.
She also doesn't like to fly, and yet she's gone all over the world.
Well, that's great. Well, let's talk about some of the other big stories in the field of bioethics last year. We just had recently this story of a pig to human heart transplant. Tell us why that's a good thing.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Right now, as I'm sure all your listeners know, there's a huge waiting list for organs, and because organ transplant medicine has just improved so tremendously that more people can benefit from it. At the same time, it used to be that a lot of organ donors were people with serious head injuries, but we've had much more increase in safe auto safety and other kinds of safety procedures so that there might even be fewer, and that's a good thing, obviously, people who suffer such catastrophic injuries. Well, that's led some people to promote very unethical and immoral approaches. Some people who are well off will go to China rather than stand in line. They will buy an organ, let's say, for $100,000 and get it after a week. The problem with that is the quote, donor, close quote, is probably a Falun Gong or other political prisoner who is tissue typed and is murdered to supply the organ for the purchaser. And that is something that is a tremendous evil that gets too little attention, but it's really very clear that this is happening now. Other things people are saying, well, let's just do away with the dead donor rule so we can, with consent, obtain organs from people who are in comas or persistent unconsciousness, this kind of thing, or even people who are disabled and want to donate organs so we can, the means of death would be the organ procurement. That's not being done, but it's being proposed. And so this pig breakthrough is a potential alleviation of that pressure to move into immoral areas. What they did is they have been working on this for some time, putting some human genes into the pigs so that the pig organs will not be rejected if they're transplanted as readily as they would normally. Pig organs actually are quite remarkably like human organs. And we already use pig heart valves, for example,
right,
in heart valve surgery,
yep,
and some other kinds of things. So what the scientists did is a gentleman was dying, and this was under compassionate use, which is a law, I think, that was passed under President Trump that allows when there's the only way to save a life is to try something experimental that can be done. So this was permitted, and the pig heart, was put in this man. It's been about 3 weeks, and he's still going. And he hasn't rejected the heart, and so there's a real potential here.
Wow.
Now, there's a caveat, a safety issue. There's a potential for a pork porcine virus to leap the species barrier in this manner.
Mm.
So there, great care has to be done, because if that should happen, there could be a pig flu outbreak that we have no resistance to.
Oh, my.
So that's something, yeah, that is, but they've been thinking about. But so it's still going to be some time away, and they have to check on that, make sure that's not happening and so forth. But this is a potential panacea, let's say in 5 to 10 years, for this organ shortage.
Wow. That's great. That is good news. Let's talk about some of the other big stories. The World Medical Association and their plan to gut medical conscience. What's involved there?
Yes, and it's not just the WHO. You have, I believe, the Biden administration is pushing a gutting of medical conscience, and you have the state of California doing so. In California, for example, there's a very important case. It's called Dignity Health. And Dignity Health is a Sacramento Catholic hospital. And a patient had created a time to have a hysterectomy, and then the patient called, or a representative called, and said, well, you know, this is a transgender surgery. So the Catholic hospital said, we can't do it for,
yeah,
two reasons. One, it would be taking out a healthy organ, which is against Catholic moral teaching,
right,
in terms of health care. You cannot take out a healthy organ. You can take out an organ when there's a pathology, but not a healthy organ.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, of course, it would sterilize the patient, which is against Catholic teaching.
Right.
This was not aimed at transgender per se. If a biological woman had come and said, you know, I want to have a hysterectomy because I don't want to get pregnant, the hospital would have said no too,
right,
in the same fashion. Well, they even actually helped the patient obtain a referral to another hospital. It took about 3 days. But, of course, guess what? The patient sued. The trial court said, no, this is freedom of religion. But the Court of Appeals, this is really frightening, said no. The Unruh Act, which is what the law is, says that it's against the law to discriminate based on sexual identity. That's what has happened here, even though the Dignity Health principles had nothing to do with sexual identity.
Right,
per se.
Right.
And so we are going to permit this case to go forward. The Supreme Court of California said, yep, we're letting the case go forward. It was brought to the United States Supreme Court on a petition for writ of certiorari, and the court sat on it a long time, and I was hopeful they'd take the case, because this is a real infringement with the free exercise of religion. But they rejected the case. So now it's a matter of how much will the jury award, if anything, to the hospital. And this is California. If the jury awards, let's say, $2 or $3 million, you might find that Catholic hospitals face to either pay these incredible damages, forced to adopt secular approaches to health care, or close. Another thing that's happening in California is UC Health. That's the University of California Healthcare System. They have a series of hospitals, but they're not in enough places to serve all of the people who benefit. These are Medicaid patients often. So the UC Health has affiliated with Catholic hospitals around the state. And they have said, we're dropping it as of 2023 unless these Catholic hospitals permit everything that's allowed in a secular hospital. Well, who's going to be hurt by that? The people that the Catholic hospital serves that can't get to a UC Health System,
right,
hospital.
Yeah,
but
right,
they don't care, because ideology comes first.
So this is a form of institutional martyrdom.
Well, you could call it that, yeah. And it's also coercion. You have the secular ideologues who really want the abortions done in Catholic hospitals, sterilizations done in Catholic hospitals, assisted suicide done in Catholic hospitals, coerced into doing this, and the coercion is lawsuits and loss of a lot of money, and B, threats to poor people who won't be able to get good health care. So it's a really despicable thing. Coercion breeds distrust, and it breeds division. And that's what UC system is doing and what I think this lawsuit is doing.
Do you know why the Supreme Court needs four justices to obtain a hearing? Do you know why only Thomas, Gorsuch, and Alito were willing to take the case? I would have thought this was a case of great importance to other justices as well.
No, they don't give you their reasons.
Right, I know.
But
yeah,
it's possible that they're saying, well, we're not going to take this case now because nothing technically has happened other than the requirement of a defense. And maybe if there's a large verdict, they'll look at it again. I don't know.
Yeah,
but here's
okay.
The problem. The Smith case, which was written by Scalia back in the 90s, says that if a law is of general applicability, meaning it's not aimed at a particular religion, and even though it violates the religious beliefs of the people of that religion, that does not violate the free exercise clause of the First Amendment. This was a terrible decision, and that's why the Religious Freedom Restoration Act was passed, was to return jurisprudence in the freedom of religion to what it had been before, that you have to have a compelling state interest in,
right,
when you're doing that. But guess what? The Biden administration and the Democratic Congress is trying to gut the Religious Freedom Restoration Act and some of the legislation that has been endorsed, passed by the House, not the Senate, and endorsed by the president. So it really is a fraught time for religious freedom, particularly Catholic health care in this country right now.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. I'm hoping that we'll wait and see how this works out.
People have to fight for Catholic health care, whether or not they're Catholic.
Yeah.
This is a matter of religious freedom. And if we're not allowed to have the kind of differences that we supposedly celebrate in this country, then we're in big trouble. If you're going to impose a particular secular ideology, you're also going to start telling doctors when they're asked for an abortion that they have to perform them. You're going to force nurses to participate in abortion or assisted suicide. So this is something that is a huge issue, I think, going forward in 2022.
Yeah. Wes, thanks. Good talking with you again and giving us this soul.
Thank you.
Again, Wes Smith, we have all the information linked at our site at alvinmariaradio.net. But again, Wes's work, he's one of those people you want to stay in touch with because he stays right on top of all these bioethical stories. I'm Al Kressler.
Okay, I've been a Catholic for 5 years. But I suffered under a lot of things due to my Protestantism as a Pentecostal, and I just want to personally ask God to bless you for your ministry, for everything you do, and the help that you give people.
EWTN, helping people grow in their love and understanding of God.
Christ is the Answer with Father John Ricardo.
John 6, verses 48 to 58. Jesus says, "I am the bread of life. Your fathers ate the manna in the wilderness, and they died. This is the bread," meaning me. "This is the bread which comes down from heaven, that a man may eat of it and never die. I am the living bread which came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread which I shall give for the life of the world is my flesh." At which the Jews disputed among themselves, saying, "How can this man give us his flesh to eat?" They're scandalized by this. How is it that we're not? How is it that we just hear this and go, "Oh yeah, I know that passage"? They're just outraged and at least perplexed. Sane people, inspired teachers, wise men, prophets don't say things like this.
Do you wish you could have discussions about difficult topics with your adult children? If so, don't worry. You're not alone. Hi, I'm Dr. Greg Popchak.
And I'm Lisa Popchak. And our new book, Having Meaningful, Sometimes Difficult Conversations with Your Adult Sons and Daughters, can help you draw closer to your adult children and help guide them on the path to more faithful and meaningful lives.
You can get our latest book and all of our other books on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Let me recall your attention to this topic, the Dignity Health case. There you have a Catholic hospital that refused to perform a hysterectomy on a patient. Now, this is standard for Catholic hospitals. It doesn't matter who the patient is. Catholic moral theology teaches that you do not remove a healthy organ. And so, as it turns out, though, in this particular case, this was a transgender patient. So the transgender patient then says, the hospital is discriminating against me based on gender, which, of course, was not true. It's standard practice for the church to not support the removal of healthy organs. It's considered a form of, really, it's a desecration of the body. And so this eventually, the case itself doesn't make its way to the Supreme Court in its fullness. They were hoping that the Supreme Court would weigh in before the case had any practical repercussions. Only Thomas Gorsuch and Alito were willing to hear the case. But mark my words, this is not over. There are going to be other ways that this case comes back. If it's not this case, it'll be one very similar to it, because I'm quite confident that the Supreme Court, as it's presently composed, wants to do something about this problem of discrimination against Catholic hospitals. More to come on this, though. I'm Al Cresta.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
Good afternoon. Glad to have you with me for another hour. We've been looking over the last 2 days the top stories of 2021. We're going to take a look at the top religious liberty stories of 2021 coming up in this hour. We'll be joined by attorney Rob Muse, co-founder of the American Freedom Law Center. We're also going to take a look at China. A new book has come out, and we've got a major hedge fund investor, Ray Dalio, who's really bullish on investment in China. And so the question is, are we seeing, has China been liberalized for all that has gone in to welcoming China into, global trade? Do we see liberalizing influences in China? Doesn't look so. So what about this question of investing in China? Dr. Sam Gregg will be joining me from the Acton Institute. We'll take a look at it. So all that's coming up. And, of course, remember, you can follow up on all these topics by going to AveMariaRadio.net and going over to the Cresta Guest Archives. You can get all the information you need that goes into the interviews and all the follow-up with our guests and their books, their articles. Right now, though, let's get to today's headlines.
Thank you, Al, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Wednesday, January 19th. It's the Feast of St. Filion. And today's news is brought to you by Charity Mobile, supporting pro-life and Catholic causes at charitymobile.com. Supreme Court Justices Sonia Sotomayor and Neil Gorsuch are disputing a report that Sotomayor had been working from home due to Gorsuch's refusal to wear a COVID mask. NPR correspondent Nina Totenberg published the report yesterday. In a joint statement today, the justices said the report is false, adding, while we may sometimes disagree about the law, We are warm colleagues and friends. French President Emmanuel Macron is calling for abortion to be added to the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights. Speaking to the European Parliament today, he said the Rights Charter, which was ratified in the year 2000, needs to be more explicit on environmental protection and the recognition of the right to abortion. The current EU Charter does not mention abortion, but in June, the Parliament voted in favor of a report describing abortion as an essential health care. The Secretary of State says diplomacy will be pursued with Russia as long as possible. Anthony Blinken's remarks come as he's set to meet with the Russian foreign minister on Friday. A Russian foreign policy analyst told Reuters the meeting is probably the last stop before the train wreck. Starbucks has rescinded its requirement that employees be vaccinated against COVID-19. The Seattle-based company made the decision following the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling that imposed a stay on the Biden administration's plan to require vaccinations or testing for companies with more than 100 employees. The company is strongly encouraging employees to be vaccinated. And a bill that would prevent most abortions in Florida after 15 weeks is up for debate today. A Florida House subcommittee is considering the so-called Reducing Fetal Infant Mortality measure. The bill is similar to a Mississippi law taken up by the U.S. Supreme Court last month. Current Florida law bans abortion after 24 weeks. With your Ave Maria Radio News, I'm Dan McGraw.
And good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. Take a look at some of the religious liberty stories of last year. With me is Rob Muse. Rob is co-founder of the American Freedom Law Center and co-author of Offensive and Defensive Lawfare, Fighting Civilizational Jihad in America's Courts. He has served 13 years in the U.S. Marine Corps, and you can follow his work at AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org. Good to have you back here.
Always great to be with you, Al.
The Supreme Court struck down the Biden administration's vaccine mandate for large corporations. It did uphold a regulation for almost all healthcare workers to be vaccinated, though. I have a hard time sorting out all these things because there's a bunch of these cases coming up now. And help us sort through what we're seeing here.
Right. And there were two separate mandates that were before the U.S. Supreme Court. Both were decided on January 13th of this year. In separate cases, and bear in mind, these were preliminary rulings. It's a question of whether or not these mandates should be stayed while the cases proceed below.
Mm-hmm.
And in one situation, the OSHA regulation, which is the one for companies that have 100 or more employees, that was stayed by the Supreme Court. So that's unenforceable right now.
Okay.
The mandate through Medicare and Medicaid, those healthcare facilities that receive those types of that funding, that mandate can go forward. It was not stayed.
Okay.
And there's also there's really an additional federal mandate, the federal contractor mandate, which if it was initiated by Biden through an executive order through the Procurement Act. If you procure activity with the government through federal contracts,
right,
then you have to have vaccines. Well, that was actually enjoined preliminarily by a federal court in Georgia, and they issued a nationwide injunction, that judge. So that didn't go up to the Supreme Court, but that's enjoined a nationwide injunction. That case is on appeal to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit, which is generally conservative. And the Biden administration asked for a stay of that injunction, and the 11th Circuit denied that, but is still working its way up. But the two that most people are hearing about is obviously the OSHA restriction and the Medicare, Medicaid, both those two particular vaccine mandates. With regard to the OSHA, and in all these situations, the way I always kind of describe the Constitution is it prevents tyranny and it protects liberty. That's the principal goal of our Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And it protects liberty, obviously, directly, we know, through the Bill of Rights. But the Bill of Rights isn't a grant of power by the government. It's a break on the power of government.
Yep.
With regard to specific inalienable rights.
Right.
Endowed.
Right.
By our Creator. That's the way.
Yep.
It was set up. But there's also, separation of powers and so forth. And so here we're dealing with the authority of the agencies and with the OSHA, which is Occupational Safety and Health Administration, and they are an organization that was created by a congressional act, the Occupational Safety and Health Act.
Right.
And so the mandate was issued pursuant to that authority by the Secretary of Labor. So the question is, does that, what the Supreme Court was addressing, was the question of whether or not that legislation by Congress enabled the Secretary of Labor to issue the mandate to these, you know, to any company that has 100 or more employees. And the Supreme Court said no,
right,
6-3. And the three that were in dissent were the three liberals, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan.
Yep.
So they were 6-3. And, you know, they made the point that, look, you know, there's – this went beyond just workplace safety, right? You can't you can put in place, you know, safety measures at work, you know, in general work. And this applied to, you know, I think one of the lines was, you know, from lifeguards to, you know, anybody, you know, to meat packers. So
right.
it applied very broadly, applied to apparently 84 million Americans, according to the Supreme Court. Think about how broad this was. They said this wasn't dealing with occupational risk and occupational hazards. This was a very broad public health mandate. And there was no Congress gave no authority to the Secretary of Labor to issue such a broad
public health
yeah. mandate okay. and try to, you know, slip it through under OSHA.
Yeah, gotcha.
And so
gotcha.
It was a question of power. The Supreme Court in that case, similar to the other case I'll discuss here, did not address the individual liberty question
okay.
and has yet to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So this was just a question of whether or not the government agency had the authority in the first place to issue the mandate. And with regard to the OSHA mandate, the court said no.
Okay.
And with regard to the mandate to to the healthcare workers, they said it did. And that was a 5-4 decision. So it was, and okay. who kind of jumped ship on that one was Kavanaugh and Roberts.
Okay.
So again, this wasn't overwhelming. This was a very, very close decision.
Yeah. Yeah.
Reading the language of the statute and there's language in the enabling legislation from Congress to the administrative agency, in that case, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, that even in they can provide for the care and protection of the patients who receive Medicare and Medicaid, including ensuring that they're protected from disease and so forth. So there's a closer connection of a vaccine mandate to the healthcare workers
yes, that's right.
than there is to just this broad, we're going to, you know, everybody who, you know, has an employees over, you know, 100 more employees, you have to have this mandate as part of an occupational health safety measure. So there was a closer connection, and it was obviously a closer decision. It was 5-4. So that mandate was originally stayed, and the Supreme Court reversed that. And so it's no longer stayed. It can go in effect. But both cases are still working their way
okay.
through the lower court. So there could ultimately be a different outcome when they get to all the merits.
In the past,
yeah.
And correct me if I'm wrong, or I may be overstating this, but this old Massachusetts decision, 1906, the Jacobson decision,
right.
Which seemed to say states had under their police powers were able to enforce vaccine mandates.
No.
Is that a significant precedent?
Not at all.
Okay.
No,
that's
not
what
at
I
all.
Want.
I mean, because number one, at that point in time, there wasn't even this concept of, and again, there was a state. So we got to separate between state and federal.
Right.
And why that's
right.
important is because even at that time, there wasn't, the Supreme Court hadn't adopted what they call the incorporation doctrine.
Yeah.
Where the Bill of Rights have not been incorporated as against the states through the 14th Amendment. Not all of them have, but many have. And certainly we did not have any development whatsoever of this
yeah.
concept of bodily integrity and personal autonomy as being protected as a matter of due process.
Right.
And even so, to the point of the there wasn't even the application of the Free Exercise Clause wasn't even applied there, nor was there even anything called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
That's right.
So there's
yeah.
so much that Jacobson doesn't even address. It's such
yeah.
an old. I mean, put it away.
Different social universe.
It should go in the dustbin of history.
Yeah,
it really it shouldn't have, and certainly not here because that was dealing with the state. So the Supreme Court hasn't addressed those personal liberty interests. That other side of the coin, right? You have the limitation on the power of government, and then you have the inability of the government to regulate in certain areas that violate individual liberty interests, those being the right to free exercise of religion. Because these are federal mandates, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act applies, which provides strong protection for religious liberty, and obviously the question of personal autonomy and bodily integrity. And,
sure.
and the court has not weighed in, has not addressed any of those in that particular
okay.
context that we're still waiting on. Not that those issues aren't working their way up, because they certainly are, but neither of those cases address any of those.
Let me go to a big decision last year, and that's Fulton v. Philadelphia. Yeah. That was a big one.
It was.
Yeah.
You know, I was disappointed in one respect, because one of the main issues that they – that they raised and why the court took it up was the question of whether or not they should overrule expressly the Smith decision. And we've talked about this in the past, but just as a reminder, that was a decision in the 90s penned by Justice Scalia, and it totally gutted the free exercise clause because it essentially didn't apply the free exercise clause to what was described as neutral laws of general applicability.
Yeah.
So if it didn't target religion specifically, then there was no free exercise claim you could make. And so that's why, you know, all these cook bakers and candlestick makers are losing their jobs and their businesses and everything else because of Smith, because most of these public accommodation laws, which they allegedly violated, are neutral laws of general applicability. And so there really is no free exercise protection.
Right.
Now, Fulton was so important because while they didn't expressly overrule Smith, they undermined it to me in ways that really, the logic of this is going to move forward. It is, because one of the main things is because there you had the Catholic social services didn't want to provide adoption services to same-sex couples, and the authority that oversaw that, the government agency that oversaw that, had the ability and the power to grant exemptions, and so because they had that power generally, they said, well, you have to grant an exemption for religious reasons. And if your reason for not doing so has to satisfy strict scrutiny, which is the highest level of scrutiny under the law, which usually means the government fails. They have to have a compelling interest and has to be narrowly tailored. And what was crucial to me in Fulton is the question of what, you know, exemptions, and often you get involved in this issue of comparisons, comparators. Okay, is this exemption the same as the other exemption? And essentially the court's saying, look, if you got to look at what is the basis for why you're granting – what is the harm that the government's trying to eliminate and overall? And if you're granting an exemption that undermines that, then you can't grant an exemption for religious reasons. For example, like for a mandate, if you have a vaccine mandate, and my view, this is how Fulton, this case would apply. If you have a vaccine mandate, and what is the government interest for a vaccine mandate? Well, we want to reduce the spread of COVID.
Right.
All right?
Right.
So that's clearly what their interest is.
Is it a
substantial interest, potentially even a compelling interest? Potentially. But then if you're going to grant a medical exemption, right, somebody might have an allergy to the virus.
Right.
Well, that person who's got the medical exemption, he can still spread the virus. Right? So now if somebody has a religious exemption, what's your compelling reason to say this guy with an allergy is should be protected, but this person who has a religious objection should not be?
Right.
And those of us who are people of faith, we care more about the health of our souls than we do about the health of our bodies.
Right.
And so when you start getting into this issue of exemptions, Fulton makes it clear that look, you the way you focus on that is important. And here's a case that I'm working with the Great Lake Justice Center. We challenged the mask mandate on behalf of Resurrection School here in Michigan. We originally lost in the Sixth Circuit before a three judge panel because they said, okay, well, yeah, they're requiring K through 12 religious schools to wear masks, but we're not requiring. But we're also requiring K through 12 public schools, and that's the only comparators. And we said, no, wait a second. You're only mandating this to schools. What about the hair salons and the movie theaters? And, you know, we all watch, you know, 100,000 people at Michigan Stadium at football games. And so what is the harm that the government's trying to prevent and why? And so we filed a petition for rehearing en banc, and the Sixth Circuit granted it.
Yeah.
And so they vacated that adverse decision and essentially said, no, look at Fulton. What does Fulton say about how you make these comparisons?
That's great.
Right? So this you know, limiting this comparison to just, well, they're public school versus religious schools. No. What is the harm that the government is trying to eliminate? And if you're allowing exemptions for that harm to continue, then you got to allow the exemptions for a religious objection. So Fulton really has it didn't overrule Smith, but boy, it brought new life to the free exercise clause, and we're seeing it in practical ways.
I have to say this was a real delight to see this Fulton decision, and you probably remember the state of Illinois, the Catholic Social Service in Illinois shut down all their adoption services.
Yeah.
Rather than fight.
Yeah.
And I don't know why they chose not to fight. But in this case, they had a contract. The Catholic Social Service, I guess, had a contract with the city of Philadelphia.
Right.
And basically the city of Philadelphia broke the contract, right? Is that what?
Well, they They couldn't continue on with contracting those services unless they provided the practice for same sex couples, and the Supreme Court said you can't impose that burden, that condition upon them,
and they were compensated. Rob, thanks.
All right, it's great to be with you, Al.
Yeah, great being with you. I'm anxious to hear more about that Resurrection School case too.
Yes, goes up. More to
so
come.
We'll talk. I'm Al Cresta. Be right back.
Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo.
No one sees a face of abortion, you know, in particular, because it's hidden by semantics, it's hidden by words, it's hidden by phrases, and, you know, and these grandiose claims of, oh, we're, you know, it's all about reproductive rights and the women, and women shouldn't be, you know, forced to carry a baby to term, especially if they were victims of rape or incest. So you put all of these ideas in people's heads that this is all about the good of a woman, but not looking at the people involved, the baby, and of course, you know, for example, a woman who we know from research, Dr. David Reardon has done a lot of research on this area, that women who do conceive through rape and carry the baby to term and either keep the child or place it up for adoption are much better off mentally. Mental health, they can deal with that, they can heal much more quickly, because two wrongs definitely don't make a right.
Catholic Connections, Teresa Tomeo. Weekdays, 9 a.m. Eastern. On EWTN Radio.
Bishops in the Catholic Church are heralds of faith, according to the Catholic Catechism. Their first task is to teach and preach the gospel to all men and women. In this, they are endowed with the authority of Christ. Christ, who is truth itself, willed to confer on the Church a share in his own infallibility in order that the people of God have true guidance as to his teaching. Christ thus endowed the Church's shepherds with the gift of infallibility when instructing in matters of faith and morals. The Pope enjoys infallibility when he proclaims by a definitive act a doctrine of faith and morals. This same infallibility is present in the College of Bishops only when, together with the Pope, they exercise the supreme magisterium, particularly in an ecumenical council. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Maybe you've been hearing a lot about the need to make a spiritual communion while participating from home in a live-streamed or broadcast Mass. By asking for spiritual communion, we are acknowledging that the Holy Mass is the perfect, best way to worship God. The priest intercedes perfectly for us with God the Father because he acts in persona Christi. This is the time to see that through the priest's representation of Christ's sacrifice on Calvary, we are never separated from our Lord. Jesus, I embrace you and unite myself wholly to you.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization, Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 75% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Support for this Ave Maria program comes in part by the not-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Shopping for insurance, mortgage products, Catholic health coverage, identity protection, or financial planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for all those and more. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
Would you get on a plane that doesn't have a pilot? Investing in passive index mutual funds may present the same issue. The Ave Maria Mutual Funds are actively managed by seasoned investment professionals to help you meet your investment goals in a morally responsible way. Ave Maria funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors could invest in the no-load Ave Maria Mutual Fund. You can learn more about the Ave Maria Mutual Funds at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. You know, over the last 30, 40 years, there's been a major shift in the global economy. You got China and India both, two most populous nations on the planet, have emerged as powerful economic forces. But my concern is China, because I remember after I got out of college, the idea was that somehow with the death of Mao Zedong in 1976, China was going to liberalize its economic policy. And Deng Xiaoping then apparently went through some period of economic reform, and China began to grow economically. Well, the idea was that if you have economic freedom, relative economic freedom in China, that's going to lead to political freedom and would destabilize and undermine the Communist Party. Well, it doesn't look like that has happened. And now China is emerging as, well, what I believe will be the chief economic competitor for the United States down the road. But join me right now to help us understand better what's going on here is Dr. Sam Gregg. He's director of research at the Acton Institute, the author of many, many books, including Reason, Faith, and the Struggle for Western Civilization. He's written widely on political economy, economic history, ethics and finance, natural law theory. He got his master's in political philosophy from the University of Melbourne and his doctor of philosophy degree in moral philosophy and political economy from the University of Oxford. Sam, it's great to have you back here. Thanks.
Al, well, thank you for having me on. It's good to be talking to you again.
Well, let me go to this. Some basic questions about China and its economy to begin with. And was the conventional wisdom after Nixon opens the door to China and after Deng Xiaoping's economic reforms, was it widely thought that, am I right to say that it was widely thought that if we have more, China is gradual entry into the global market, it's going to produce a more open and free China when it comes to individual human liberties or human rights. Was that the rationale behind this?
Well, I think that for the United States, the ultimate rationale for China's entry into the World Trade Organization in 2000-2001 was that it would open up a market of 1.4 billion people for American businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what happened.
Right.
And that's been immensely beneficial for American consumers in terms of 330 million consumers who now have cheaper access to all sorts of goods and services as a consequence of that.
That's right.
But what you're talking about is the sense, which I think really started to develop following the fall of communism in Russia and Eastern Europe in 1989-1990, that letting a country experience or embark upon a certain degree of economic liberalization, such countries would find it very hard to stop the taste for freedom to be confined to economic life, that it would spill over into more civil liberties, more political liberalization, more freedom in general. And this was very much part of an argument that became very popular in the early 1990s that was associated with a scholar named Francis Fukuyama and his book, The End of History and the mm-hmm. Last Man. Right. And as you know, this book basically said, look, in the end, all societies are going to end up as market economies and liberal democracies. That's inevitable.
Yeah.
He used the type of Hegelian logic to explain why this was the case. And there might be bumps up on the way, but that's where we're all going to end up. And that type of thinking, I would argue, influenced a fair number of foreign policy thinkers on both the, let's call them the center-right and the center-left in the United States. And this was a broad consensus by a lot of foreign policy thinkers. And you saw this in the year 2000, where you had people like Bill Clinton saying that, look, China's not perfect, but economic liberalization is likely to lead to more political liberty. And the then Republican presidential candidate, George W. Bush, saying more or less the same thing. Now, mm-hmm. there were lots of caveats around it and all that, but more or less that was what they were saying. Flash forward to 2016, 2017, and the Trump administration issues its national security policy, which basically says that the argument that I just outlined, that economic liberalization would lead to a freeing up of society inside China and other similar regimes that might go down this path, that this has turned out not to be true. And I happen to think that's more or less a correct assessment. And I think here's the mistake I think that lots of people made, lots of good, well-intentioned people made. And I think they underestimated the fact that China has a 5,000-year tradition of authoritarian top-down rule. And political cultures don't change that easily. So that's the first thing. The second thing, I think, is that there was a change in mentality within China itself around about 2008, partly because a lot of people in China, policymakers in China, were looking at what happened during the financial crisis, and they started making more critical assessments of the United States economy and the United States in general, and starting to ask questions about whether this was a type of prefiguring of a decline of American power. The third thing that happened was people came to power in China, including the current President Xi, who took the view that they were not interested in China becoming a liberal democracy. And in his case, I think he's actually quite suspicious of economic liberty as well, because he wants to centralize as much power as possible, which is very consistent with Chinese political culture. So those, I think, are some of the dynamics that played out over time, and which means we're living in a very different world compared to the world that existed in 1990, which was a much more optimistic world. Now, I happen to be very much, as you know, very much an advocate of markets and market liberalization. I think it's good for America, it's good for the world, it's good for, especially for the poor. But I do think that free marketers have to be very careful about making this sort of assumption, this, I would call it an almost deterministic assumption, that other freedoms will automatically flow from some degree of economic liberalization.
Well, we've got this Bridgewater Associates founder, Ray Dalio, who's got a tremendous amount of respect right now. His book has endorsements from a lot of the big names in business. Dalio is a champion, is championing China's push for what is called, quote, common prosperity or greater equality. And he is he's bullish on investment in China. What can you tell me about this fellow and whether this common prosperity idea is something he thinks the United States would be benefit by it? What's this all about?
Well, it is the idea that the regime, Beijing, has basically decided that it wants economic prosperity in the country to be more evenly spread. I mean, that's more or less what they mean by common prosperity, at least domestically. The problem, I think, with that argument is twofold. One, if you are a member of the Communist Party in China, you automatically have a leg up over everyone else in the country who is not a member of the Chinese Communist Party. What that means is that you have access to power, you have access to position, you have access to education that is not generally accorded to people who are not party members. So inequality, both political and to a certain extent economic, is baked in to the very nature of the CCP regime in China itself. So I think we have some reasons to be skeptical about the degree to which China wants to do this. The second thing I would say is that the Chinese economy has enormous problems right now, and I think we underestimate how big those problems are. And I think they make any talk of a more common prosperity really rather a side issue, frankly, given the problems that China has right now. its population problem, by which I mean it doesn't have enough people, it's this one-child policy has turned out to be a disaster, is going to cause China enormous problems when it comes to health spending, welfare spending in the future, because when you have a shrinking population, it means you have older people and fewer younger people to support them.
Right.
The second thing is that as China has moved back more in the direction of a more traditional state-run, state-orientated economy, all the problems associated with that type of economic arrangement are starting to manifest themselves in China as we speak. I find it very telling that since 2011, China's official National Statistics Agency has made more and more information inaccessible to not just people from outside China, but from people in China as well. That tells you that they know there are things going on in the Chinese economy that are not good. We have also seen growth rates in China, many of which, frankly, I haven't believed for a long time because I think, like a lot of other authoritarian regimes, statistics agencies in these countries tend to tell their political masters what they want to hear.
Mm-hmm.
But they have more and more restricted information about what's really going on. And I think that's because these deeper-seated problems, whether it's the population problem they have, whether it's the inefficiencies and ineffectiveness that's associated with more and more of the economy being driven in this collectivist direction, but also some of the massive failure that the Chinese economy has experienced. And you see this in things like cities or large towns with no one living
there. Right.
It's been sort of built, and
right,
they're just sitting there in the middle of nowhere,
yeah,
with no people in them. I mean, that's a sign of an economy and a political system that's becoming dysfunctional. So when people ask me about China, I will always say, look, it's a very big market. It's 1.4 billion people. Businesses need to think very seriously before they say, okay, we really don't want to do business there. But even foreign investors now are starting to pull out or rethink or restructure the way they do business in China because they're very aware of all of these particular problems.
Yeah. Sam, can you stay with me a little longer?
Sure.
Very good. My guest, Dr. Sam Gregg, we're talking about what to do about China. We've got the Olympics starting soon. We also have, well-known investors championing increased investment in China. China is touting that it had an 8.1% economic growth last year. Really?
Location, location, relocation. Studies show more than a third of college students transfer, and half of those do it more than once. He reminds us of St. Augustine's quote, "Our souls are restless until they rest in thee." At Ave Maria University, we challenge this group to visit us, stroll down our palm tree paths, spike a shot on our sand volleyball court, or partake in an outdoor devotion. There's a reason when students visit Ave Maria, they tend to stay. Ave Maria University, your relocation destination. Visit avemaria.edu.
This program is brought to you in part by Charity Mobile, a proud partner of Ave Maria Radio for over 15 years. Charity Mobile is the pro-life cell phone company and has sent nearly $2 million to thousands of pro-life charities. 4G LTE coverage is available nationwide, and 5% of your monthly plan price goes to your favorite pro-life charity. A video introduction is available at CharityMobile.com. Charity Mobile. Everyday living. Effortless giving. CharityMobile.com.
We are the pro-life generation, passionate about building the culture of life in our healthcare and in our nation. But not all healthcare options are equally pro-life, and some provide morally objectionable procedures. CMF Curo is different. CMF Curo is a pro-life Catholic healthcare ministry providing a pathway for its members to build the culture of life in their healthcare choices, not destroy it. Learn more about CMF Curo at MyCatholicHealthcare.com. That's MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
This week at Ave Maria Radio's Poll of the Week, we want to know, which of the major cases currently being considered at the Supreme Court do you think is the most significant? Go to AveMariaRadio.net and scroll down to the Poll of the Week to let us know.
With so much going on in the world, it's easy to feel overwhelmed. What do you need to know today? Stay tuned to Cresta in the Afternoon and Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo as we bring you the day's top stories and conversations from an authentic Catholic perspective.
Christ is the answer. With Father John Ricardo.
in the midst of our culture today, in this age of relativism, which wants to grant Jesus some significance, but not so much. So we'll give him wise man, great leader, inspiring preacher, great teacher, prophet. You don't get that option when you claim to be God. What reasons do we have to believe that he is who he said he is? And it's important, again, to employ the use of our reason and to understand that faith is not blind. My faith, and please God, the faith of everyone here, is not blind. It rests on something. It rests on a number of things, not least of which is my own experience of God, but it also has something substantial which can be claimed through history. We're not talking about a galaxy long, long ago, far, far away when we talk about Jesus. We're talking about a precise moment in history which has been testified to by countless testimonies, and you and I have access to them.
Do you wish you could have discussions about difficult topics with your adult children? If so, don't worry. You're not alone. Hi, I'm Dr. Greg Popcheck.
And I'm Lisa Popcheck. And our new book, Having Meaningful, Sometimes Difficult Conversations with Your Adult Sons and Daughters, can help you draw closer to your adult children and help guide them on the path to more faithful and meaningful lives.
You can get our latest book and all of our other books on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
The EWTN home video highlight for August is I Am With You, a documentary on Carlo Acutis. This EWTN original documentary brings you the remarkable story of Blessed Carlo Acutis. Family, friends, neighbors, and classmates paint a moving picture of this impressive young man whose spiritual wisdom far surpassed his age. Order your DVD at EWTNRC.com 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or call 1-800-854-6316.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me, Dr. Sam Gregg, taking a look at China and some highly publicized calls for increased investment in China on the lips of Ray Dalio, founder of Bridgewater Associates. He's got many people thinking that we should be bullish on investment in China, trying to understand exactly what that means, given the Chinese Communist Party. I was listening to a lecture just yesterday in which the professor of economics suggested that China, we should expect China to become the world's largest economy in the world sometime in the 2020s, and leading me to ask the question, well, if that's the case, what are the rewards for being the world's largest economy? What does that actually mean? I don't think there's any trophy for it. But first of all, Sam, should we expect, will China be the world's largest economy inevitably in the next 10 years?
Well, I tend to be skeptical of that claim. I'm old enough, or maybe young enough, to remember a time in the, you will remember this, Al, in the late 1980s, early 1990s. I was a teenager, but I distinctly remember being told that Japan was the future. Remember that?
Yes, I do. I remember John Chancellor's book, I think it was called Peril or Promise. I can't remember. Peril or Promise, in which he was scared to death that Japan was going to take us. Yeah.
There are all these books that came out telling us that Japan was the future. Films like Black Rain were very popular. Even the film Die Hard, remember, it was all about a Japanese corporation, right?
Yes.
So we've had occasions like this before. And what happened with Japan? Well, at the very moment when American commentators and many policymakers were talking about Japan becoming the future, the Japanese economy entered what has been called the lost 20 years of more or less what we would call a type of stagnant economy. And there's all sorts of reasons for that. Their population problem had something to do with that. Bad loans had something to do with that. The use of government industrial policy to prop up inefficient parts of the economy and otherwise divert capital to inefficient parts of the economy. All these had an effect. And what's interesting about China, I think, is that precisely because they're moving back in this direction, and President Xi has made it very clear that he wants capitalism, Chinese style, to be Chinese state capitalism, in which the state is the driving force of the economy.
Right.
We
right.
have every reason to believe that that experiment in a type of collectivist economy, albeit one with, let's say, more features of a market economy than we saw certainly in, say, the Soviet Union, there's every reason to believe that the Chinese model of state capitalism will run into many of the similar problems that all previous experiments with this type of political economy have run into, whether it's massive misallocations of capital, whether it's people lying, simply lying on an everyday basis about what's really going on in the economy,
mm-hmm.
whether it's things like the state encouraging practices and habits that discourage investment. So, for example, if you go to China and you do business there, they expect you to do everything in terms of contracts under Chinese law.
Right.
Would you want to be an American business executive signing contracts in China, which will be subject to Chinese judges, knowing full well that things like rule of law and due process mean nothing
That's
in a
right.
country which, politically speaking, is essentially a communist authoritarian state.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they have all sorts of these internal problems, but also the logic of the direction in which they're heading, I think, suggests to us that the Chinese economy, far from being the greatest economy the world has ever seen, is likely to run into some significant problems.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is reason for us to be skeptical of claims that somehow China is the future.
I mean, it is hard to imagine China becoming the financial hub of the world, because there you've got to have pretty free access to information. You know, other nations, I mean, I can't imagine China functioning as the financial hub in the same way that the United States functions as the financial hub.
Well, and part of that, Al, is that this is where we start to understand that good institutions, and maybe even more importantly, the type of economic culture that prevails in a given society is really important. Because mainland China does not have a history under the regime it's currently living under of strong respect for property rights,
right.
of relatively fair enforcement and interpretation of contracts, of the existence of rule of law. These things are lacking in mainland China, and I would argue now in places like Hong Kong as well. And it's very difficult to see how China can embrace those things without the Communist Party, to some extent, giving up its monopoly of power and its monopoly of controlling the most important positions in the country. So, if you like, as long as the Chinese Communist Party, particularly with its current leader, insists on its primary position in Chinese society, the Chinese economy is going to have these big institutional problems that won't just discourage foreign investment, but will also hinder the development of things like capital markets, which need good institutions and a sort of very basic culture of a certain minimal degree of honesty and trust, which I would suggest doesn't exist in much of mainland China today.
Yeah. Does China really control the global flows of capital in and out of China in ways that the United States would not?
Well, you have to, when you invest in China, you have to declare everything, obviously, right? So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, there are controls in the sense you need to notify people of what's going in and what's going out. That's same in the United States as well. But I think what really matters is the ability of capital to shift around quickly as it sees
yeah.
new investment, new opportunities, based upon the economic sense of a given project or endeavor. In mainland China today, that has a lot less to do with what's good economics. It's got much more to do with, do you know people in the party?
Right.
Do you know people with political connections? If you go into a room where you're meeting with a group of Chinese business executives from the same company, the most important person in the room is not the CEO. The most important person in the room is whoever is the most senior Communist Party official.
Right.
And that means that the types of choices that people make about their investments are remarkably driven by political considerations rather than good economic considerations. And that's not a recipe for long-term growth, let alone the growth of solid capital markets. Now, there's a lot of cronyism in the United States as well. I'm not suggesting that there isn't. There's plenty of cronyism,
and the more
we can do to reduce it, the better. But in China, the degree to which what's often called crony capitalism exists dwarfs, believe you me, it dwarfs anything that we have in the United States. And that is not good for their future economic prospects.
Yeah. And as you point out, the supremacy of the party is baked right into the communist system there. So there's the economy has to always be in a sense in league with the goals of the existing political party. So I don't know how it could ever become
that's
truly independent.
Right. And Xi has made that very clear.
Yep.
So for example, Chinese companies are required to put into their business statements some type of level of commitment to the Communist Party's goals for China, both economically, politically, and in terms of foreign policy. They're required to write this stuff in to their statement of purposes. So that gives you, can you imagine American companies doing that?
No.
Saying that our objective is to promote the United States way of life. No, companies don't do that because that's political.
Right.
But in China, this is the type of thinking and expectation that is now being pushed further and further into everyday Chinese economic life. And you might say, well, it sounds very tokenistic, and maybe it is tokenistic, but it does reinforce in the minds of people who are working in business, in the wider economy in China, that the party's political goals are not something to be laughed at, and they are something that the regime certainly takes seriously at some level.
And President Xi believes that when he is talking about community with a common destiny, he's talking about Chinese hegemony as well, right? I mean, when he talks about this China's Belt and Road initiatives, this is intended in the long run to extend China's, and again, the Communist Party's influence over these other areas of the globe. Am I wrong?
Yes. I mean, what you're referring to is what's called the Belt and Road Initiative. And this is basically China investing in infrastructure and putting capital investment into particular parts of the world that it regards as strategic for China. So places like the Near East, certain parts of Africa, different parts of the world where China believes it has strategic interests. Now, what is it driven by is not good economics. It's not driven by what's a good investment choice in terms of what's going to produce a substantial return to shareholders and to the owners. It's driven by politics. Now, what's interesting about this is that more often than not, these investments go very, very bad. In fact, since 2016, China has scaled back and size of its Belt and Road Initiative precisely because it's turning out to be not just economically costly, but it also generates enormous resentment in many parts of the world in which the Chinese have tried to deploy what's called BRI, into these different economies, places like Pakistan, places like Malaysia. There are a lot of people in these countries now who deeply resent China's presence in their societies because they recognize that this infrastructure investment, this capital investment is part of a political project. It's not like American business leaders going abroad and investing in a country. They're not doing it because they want to take over the country. They're doing it because they see things like cheap labor, or maybe there's a comparative advantage of outsourcing part of their businesses to a part of the world. And
otherwise,
it's all driven by economic considerations. It's not about trying to extend American global hegemony in the sense of strategy in politics. That's a very big difference.
Let me take you to the question of the Beijing Olympics, then. It's, there's a lot of discussion about whether the United States should be participating. There's been a diplomatic boycott. How do you regard the political and economic dimension of the Beijing Olympics?
Well, I think the good news is that the Olympics are not taken as seriously now as they were, say, 20, 30 years ago. I think there's so many sports events now that I don't think people pay anywhere near as much attention. But basically, I think the regime will use it as a way of trying to present themselves as the new coming power.
Yeah.
That's what I think it will turn into. And then countries around the world need to decide what stance they want to adopt in relation to
it. Yeah. Okay. Sam, thanks. Always great talking with you. Very helpful.
Thanks, Al.
Dr. Sam Gregg, his article, What to Do About China, we'll have posted at our website, as well as other articles of his relative to China.
Would you get on a plane that doesn't have a pilot? Investing in passive index mutual funds may present the same issue. The Ave Maria Mutual Funds are actively managed by seasoned investment professionals to help you meet your investment goals in a morally responsible way. Ave Maria funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors could invest in the no-load Ave Maria Mutual Fund. You can learn more about the Ave Maria Mutual Funds at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
If I disciplined consistently, I'd be disciplining constantly. If I were consistent in my discipline, that would mean I would discipline more. And I'd be disciplining him often. The exact opposite is the case. More consistent discipline leads to less constant discipline. Why? Because you're predictable. The child knows if he does A, you'll do B. That is why, when you are predictable in your authority, you will actually have to use that authority less. Consistent discipline leads to less constant discipline. The more you act when you need to act, the less you will have to act in the future with similar misbehavior.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
You remember the time I said on the air, go to confession, and when you're done, go out and have a big ice cream soda. Celebrate. And a man wrote to me, he says, you know, I hadn't gone to confession in 30 years. Do you mind if I went and had a pizza? I said, oh, have 20 pizzas.
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
Well, thank you very much. It's been good being with you, and I look forward to tomorrow. As you may know, Alice Van Hildebrand has passed from this world, and Alice has been really an outstanding champion of the faith. Her husband, Dietrich Van Hildebrand, who we've talked about on this program, was a major force in opposing Hitler. And was also a very, very brilliant philosopher. We're going to take a look at Alice's life tomorrow with John Henry Crosby, who's been a strong champion of von Hildebrand's thinking. So that's coming up on tomorrow's Christ in the Afternoon. As I go off the air, though, Carlo Broussard on Catholic Answers Live, taking your questions on the whys of Catholic belief.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.